Groundfish Committee report behind tab 3. There's three main areas for discussion today. TMGC catch recommendations, ACLs for fishing years 2010 to 2012 with final action planned in November, and discussion of a letter dated August 24th from the regional office. Turn it over to Rip Cunningham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think before I give my actual report, I would turn it over to Jim to do the TMGC report.
Okay, I think there's a PowerPoint on there, and start off with that. A little over a week ago, George LaPointe, co-chair of the TMGC, myself, Tom Warren from National Marine Fisheries Service, Loretta O'Brien from the New England Science Center, Fred Sirchuk from New England Science Center, and Ann Hawkins from the New England Council staff, went to Canada and had our annual TMGC meeting where we go over the status of the transboundary cod, haddock, and yellowtail stocks and to come up with the appropriate catch levels for next year. Let's start out with cod. Start out with cod. Given the recent, I'm not going to review the track recommendations. We had that this morning, so I'll just go right to what the TMGC did. Given the poor recruitment of recent recruitment, the TMGC sought to reduce the risk of a biomass decline in the cod stocks in eastern Georgia's. 2003 year class is expected to contribute about one third of the catch in 2010. The TAC for eastern Georgia's bank cod for the 2010 fishing year is recommended to be 1,350 tons. That is a decrease from 1,700 tons in 2009. The TAC of 1,350 metric tons results in a national quota to the U.S. of 338 metric ton and 1,012 metric tons for the Canadian side. For haddock, the biomass is currently highest in the assessment series. Risk of biomass decline is not pertinent. Fishing mortality has been at 0.13 in 2007 and 0.09 in 2008. The adult biomass is projected to peak of 156 metric tons in 2009, reflecting recruitment and growth of the 2003 year class, and declined to 95,000 tons in 2011. The TAC for Eastern Georgia's Bank haddock for 2010 fishing year is recommended to be 29,600 metric tons. It was 30,000 metric tons in 2009. This results in a national quota of 11,988 ton for the U.S. and 17,612 tons for Canada. This represents a low to neutral risk of exceeding the FRF of 0.26. I'll add that the U.S. and Canada agreed on these tacks that I've just presented on haddock and cod. Yellowtail flounder, however, caused the TMGC significant challenges, and the TMGC was unable to reach consensus on 2010 tack for Georgia's Bank. For Georgia's Bank yellowtail. The U.S. position on yellowtail flounder was constrained to be no greater than 15 metric ton, consistent with the current recommendation on the rebuilding plan for Georgia's Bank yellowtail flounder, specified in the multi-species fisheries management plan. The Canadian position was, at the outset, was 27,000 metric tons, and they came back and went down to 2,100 metric ton. And their rationale is that the 2,100 metric tons didn't represent any risk to the resource, and the resource would still continue to build. So I think this is the first time we've had a situation where we couldn't reach agreement with the Canadians on a start. So that's going to, we don't know what to do about that. Any questions so far?
Any questions for Jim? Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, Jim. The cod amount is $13.50.
That's correct.
Okay. You recall if that corresponds to the natural mortality of 0.5 or 0.2? And there's two models that we were shown this morning. And it seemed to me that we were given two choices with no preference or recommendation from the track regarding which one to select. So how does this particular recommendation relate to the natural mortality rate options that we have?
Yeah, it corresponds to an average of the two models and for a neutral risk of biomass decline.
Any other questions for Jim?
Then I'm going to offer a motion, and the motion is that the council accept the TMGC recommendations for fiscal year 2010, fishing year 2010. The TAC for Eastern Georgia's Bank Cod will be 1,350 tons. The U.S. will be 338 metric ton. Canadian, 1,012 metric ton. And the TAC for Eastern Georgia's Bank Haddock will be 29,600 metric ton. The U.S. will be 11,988 metric ton, and Canada will be 17,612 metric ton.
You get a second? Seconded by Terry Stockwell. Discussion, Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, relative to the Mr. Cohen. Oh, I'm sorry. Yellowtail is not part of this motion.
Right.
Okay. Sorry.
Council members on the motion. Rodney.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question. You said that the Canadians did not agree with us. What's going to happen after that? And I know you said you didn't know, but maybe Pat or someone could answer that question. They don't agree with you.
That was on Yellowtail. Do you want to wait until we... Yeah.
Okay, to the motion on the board, Cod and Haddock. Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Opposed? Opposed? Abstentions? One abstention. The motion carries 15-0. One abstention.
I mean, that's the conclusion of the TMGC report. The question out there now is, where do we go with Yellowtail?
I think that was part of Rodney's question as well. So now maybe if Pat wants to weigh in.
Well, we've got a couple of options. We do have the SSC recommendation of 1,500 metric tons, and the council can't go beyond that. And so the source of the disagreement with the Canadians, of course, was that they weren't willing to go down to 1,500 metric tons. So the one option that we have in this process is for us to refer it back to the TMGC for reconsideration. Now, I think that the battle was pretty hard fought, and that may not be worth the time, but I'm just trying to lay out the options that are available to the council. Even in that situation, you know, nothing could change, or potentially nothing would change, and so the council does need to take action on COD today. I think the alternative for the council is to accept the 1,500 metric tons, except that Canada, that we don't know what Canada is going to do and won't know, according to them, till pretty close to the start of their fishing year, which is January 1. And then do what we do in other situations where we don't, in fact, have these kinds of understandings with the Canadians, and that's make some assumptions about what they might do for 2010, and then build that into the U.S. TAC.
Roddy?
Yeah, unless maybe I'm wrong, but I thought part of this agreement was because they could take theirs right off the top and we'd be left with what was left. So in this scenario, if they don't agree to this and they overfish, does that mean we get nothing?
Well, it doesn't, no, because it doesn't matter what they actually do. What you do at this point, and what the only thing we can do at this point, is make some assumptions about what they might do based on what they've done in the past, and then set the U.S. TAC based on that. And then what's not clear to me, and I haven't really fully thought through, is what happens next year, because technically, even if they set a much higher TAC, they won't have gone over an understanding, and so there's not necessarily any repercussions in the following year for them. But I think all we can do right now is look at what they've done and us make, as I said, an assumption for 2010.
Jimmy?
Yeah, I thought I'd take a minute to, and I think it's important to lay out the Canadian position before we move on, just so that it's on the record and that we've given them that courtesy. And the position of the Canadians was that a TAC of 2,100 metric ton in 2010 is appropriate because the yellowtail biomass is at the highest since 1973. Fishing mortality is at the lowest, and there is an exceptional year class and one average year class recruiting. Their position was a TAC equal to 2,100 metric ton results in virtually no risk of exceeding FRF in 2010 and also is an appreciable biomass growth for 2011. Continued fishing at this F, less than 0.10, results in appreciably greater than 50% probability of reaching BMSY by 2014, respecting the intent of the Magnuson-Stevens Fisheries Conservation and Management Act. And this was the Canadian position, so I just wanted to lay that out, and that's where we diverge. If I understand what Pat's saying is, I think the Canadians took something like approximately 200 tons last year, bycatch and directed and Canadian bycatch. So if I'm hearing that right, we would take 200 tons off 1,500 tons, and our TAC would be 1,300?
Well, that's one way to look at it, but the Canadians have already indicated that, of course, they've not allowed a directed fishery in the last 4 or 5 years.
They've allowed directed fisheries. They just haven't prosecuted one.
I'm sorry.
Okay, so
they don't allow landings.
There is a big difference in that. Okay.
they make
Your
an allocation,
right.
But they don't allow landings from directed fisheries, only from the scallop bycatch. No? Sorry, go ahead.
No, they allow a directed fisheries on yellowtail flounder. There's no restrictions from them for having it. They haven't prosecuted a directed fisheries on yellowtail flounder because they're busy with haddock. Okay? So there is that's a big distinction, you know, and I would just throw it out there that if they're going to have the same tack as on haddock next year, the chance of them having a significant directed fisheries on yellowtail is the same as it's been in the past couple of years. They just don't have the capacity. The boats are busy filling their haddock quota.
You can't.
As to what Jan told me, though.
Okay.
Jan very clearly told me.
You're right, it is important. I appreciate the clarification that we've actually been told, though, by the Canadians that they haven't actually allowed it and that this year they're going to have, what are they calling it?
A test fishery.
A test fishery to allow some directed fishing for yellowtail. I think, you know, you've sort of bounded the options here. One of them is assume they're going to catch what they caught last year, and the other one is just assume that we did agree to the understanding, and we take the share we would have gotten under the understanding, assuming they're going to take the share they would have gotten under the understanding. So, or, you know, theoretically they could go up to 2,100 metric tons, which is much higher even, so I guess that's actually the upper bound.
I guess I'm sorry, I don't follow that, Pat. If assuming what they're going to take under the understanding, but what is the overall? What would be the overall? There is no understanding if we can't agree on an overall tack. So are we going to assume they're going to take their percentage of 2,100 or assume they're going to take a percentage of the 1,500?
Well, yeah, that was my point. I do think the upper bound is assuming they're going to take not take 2,100, but operate under the understanding at 2,100, versus assuming at the lower end of the bound that they're going to take what they took last year. And, you know, I would argue that we should probably be somewhere in between those two.
Yeah, just a clarification. When the TMGC left Canada, was there an understanding between all parties concerned that the U.S. had accepted the situation, TMG anyways, had accepted the situation that 2,100 for the Canadians, 1,500 would be the bottom line for the U.S.? In other words, did the Canadians think that they got an agreement, at least at that particular meeting?
No, there was agreement not to agree. We could not agree. There is, for all practical purposes, there's no agreement on what the TAC of yellowtail will be under the TMGC agreement this year.
Okay, thank you. And the number that the Canadians picked, the 2,100, you've given us an explanation, Jim, as to why they selected that. I'm curious, did their position reflect the survey information, the biomass information that we heard this morning regarding the one big toe? In other words, were they influenced by that by the Canadian DFO survey that resulted in the much higher biomass level as compared to the U.S. assumption that we drew based upon our own survey in U.S. waters? I'm just curious, did they use the one toe, the one big toe, as a basis for their decision, or was it more than that?
No, they did not. The 2,100 doesn't represent the model that includes that. It actually is below the conservative model without that excludes that. I think it was 2,700, according to the 2,700 tons could have come out on the model excluding the Canadians stuff. So they were even backed off from that, so to speak. Is that correct, Tom?
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, regarding options, certainly we have to discuss the options available to us at this moment. I'm curious if there are any other options that are more long-term that are being pursued right now by the National Marine Fisheries Service. In particular, we all recall the National Standard Number 1 guidelines as proposed, that the U.S.-Canadian understanding is not considered to be a treaty. A number of individuals, including my agency, suggested that this understanding should be considered like a treaty, and therefore we get ourselves away from the bind we find ourselves in now. You know, but the service had some good rationale as to why that would be inappropriate. Is the service now attempting to try to correct the situation by, is anybody working on legislation that might get us out of this fix, long-term versus short-term?
Yes. No, just kidding.
Yes.
People are working on legislation. We've been working with congressional staff. I know several members of the industry have been working with congressional staff. There's some drafts floating out there of possible legislation. We saw a draft last week and had a conference call with congressional staff on. I think it was the same day the TMGC was meeting. I think in speaking with them, their hope is to finalize something as quickly as possible. It's being drafted on the House side right now. They're hoping to share it with the House soon and then introduce it soon after that. But I think there's a lot of interest in providing a legislative change to recognize the understanding.
Jimmy.
Yeah, I don't have my calculator right in front of me, but have you run the numbers? If we took 2,100 minus the 36%, what's our TAC?
I may have done it. I was doing a little chicken scratch over here. Okay. So if Canada goes with 2,100 and they take their 36%, which is, according to the document, the split, that means you deduct 756 tons. Off of what we're bound to, which is 1,500. And then I think you have to remember that for this stock, we also have, I think, at a minimum 10% set aside for the scallop industry. Is that right? At a minimum? No? Tom?
No, that's not correct. There's only a 10% set aside during the years when they have access to one of the closed area one or two access programs, and I don't believe access is... I forget whether access is scheduled in fishing year 2010, but I don't think it is.
Okay.
So technically in 2010, there's no minimum.
Okay. So just taking the 756 off, you'd end up with 644, is it? 744 tons, U.S. domestic. David.
Yeah, well, this is the information I was going to ask for, but I think it should be less than it should be more than that. The if you have 2,100, you've got 756 and 1,344. What's the split at 1,500? What's the Canadian number there? It's still 756? No. It's 36% of 1,500, right? So the difference we should take off is the difference between that number and the 756, because they'd be entitled under the 1,500 to catch that anyway. I don't have a calculator. I have to sit down and do this by hand, but I don't think it comes out to 756 coming off the U.S. side.
What do you want to know, Dave? What's 36% to 1,500?
The numbers John said were right. The difference between the two is 216 tons. You subtract 216 from 960, and I think you get 744, which is just a different way of calculating the same thing.
Yeah, I understand the closed area we take off 10%, but I thought under 16, which will be the controlling thing when we start 2010 fishing year, we had to account for the scallop catch.
Well, we do.
So
it's just not an automatic 10%.
Right. Well, we'd have to deal with that today, is my point. It's not just we can ignore that. We've got to figure that out today.
I guess I have a question about the agreement. So we don't have an understanding on Yellowtail. We know what the thinking was of the two parties, but we don't have an understanding. We'll make our assumptions and go through this process. We'll prosecute our fishery. They'll do the same. And we'll meet back up again next year, potentially. And how do you reconcile? In other words, how do you claim someone owes a payback one way or the other if you didn't agree? Pat?
That's what I was saying to Rodney. I didn't really think fully through to next year yet, but it seems to me there is no way to claim that there's a payback.
So you would go through the process again next year. You'd have your assessment scientists from the United States and Canada determine the relative abundance or health of the resource, and you'd go through the process one more time and start from square one and see if you can see if you're any closer together or not, right? So I was just thinking that through on that end. Anyone else? Jimmy?
Yeah, I mean, I really have a problem thinking that they're going to take 744 tons, or 36% of 2,100. It's not, and the reason being is because I know that the fisheries, and I know that they're struggling to catch the haddock stock. So I think we would be, we could take somewhere in the middle of what they're doing today and what they could do at the maximum, and be pretty safe. I mean, it's to take our industry from, I think the tack was 1,700 this year, to 700 is, and then have to figure out what we're going to do about the scallop industry. We're going to have our own problems here, and this is not a light problem because the scallop industry is at stake. So I think we need to be somewhere in the middle of 200 and 744, not at the outside. So that's just my thoughts.
We have a similar experience, not that it brings up good memories for some, but with herring. We have to assume a certain amount of catch in the herring for the Canadian weir fishery. And maybe I'm wrong, but I think we look back and average a period of time and average the catches and say that's what we're going to assume moving forward. I don't know if that's a similar strategy we could adopt here, absent an agreement. Anyone else on the council? Rip?
I guess my question is one of process. Do we need to have a motion that indicates we accept the 1,500? Are we just automatically bound by that because that's the essentially the ABC? And then secondarily, once we agree on that, do we need to have something which says this is what we suggest as the process for figuring out what our share will be?
Yes. Jimmy.
I wasn't going to bring this up, but I thought of a way. I mean, this is a problem. This is going to be, I think, for the industry, is going to be a major problem if we start ended up with numbers of 740 tons on a resource that's the highest it's been since 1973. I mean, and it's going to cause problems in the scallop industry as well as the dragging industry. So, you know, this is self-imposed by the council. There is a way around this. I mean, we can adjust our control rules. And we have an extra year or two that we took short on the rebuild just precisely so we could make adjustments. And we could change the probabilities from 75% to 50%. Then we could be in line with what the Canadians are thinking. And I don't know the mechanism for that. Maybe it's a framework, maybe it's in the specs, but if we don't take on something like that and we just stick with these numbers, you know, we could have sector problems, we can have scallop problems. So it's within our, at least my thinking, that we could fix this.
Tom Neese.
I just want to point out a few things that may not be familiar to people who haven't been involved closely with the U.S.-Canada process. I just want to make it clear, we've got two assessments, different results, different formulations, but no real preference between the two assessments. These tacks that we're talking about, 1,500 or 2,100 tons, just so everybody's clear, are nowhere near the overfishing level under either assessment. Under the worst assessment, I think the overfishing level that was calculated by the TRAC is somewhere on the order of 5,000 tons, and under the more optimistic assessment, I think the overfishing level is 7,000 tons. So I just want to make sure everybody understands that. We're not talking about the difference. These differences we're talking about are not whether we're going to allow overfishing or not. That's not the case. So the differences that we're talking about here are really related to the requirement for the F rebuild number. And rebuilding with a 75% probability by 2014, under the worst case assessment, you need a TAC of something like 450 metric tons. And under the more optimistic assessment, the TAC is higher, i.e., I think it's 2,600 tons. So that's actually a pretty wide range. If you, some of the work we did for the SSC indicated that, you know, these tacks we're talking about that are in the range of 2,100 metric tons, which the Canadians are talking about, under the worst-case assessment, that still has a better-than-median chance of rebuilding by 2014, just barely. It's a 54% probability. And under the best-case assessment, a 2,100 metric ton tack gives you an 81% probability of success. So, you know, in one case, better than the council's objective. In the other case, it's worse than the council's objective, but still meets the legal requirement to build by 2014. If you take a look at the numbers that were floating around, if we were to base our share on the 1,500-ton tack, which is 960 tons, and then you were to say, okay, the Canadians are going to take 756, which is their share of 2,100 metric tons, then what you're talking about for the total catch of the fishery is like 1,716, you know, 200 tons more than the TAC we agreed on. And I don't really have what the probability of rebuilding by 2014 would be at 1,716, but it would be something higher than a median probability of rebuilding. And that would be if you held that F all the way through, which, of course, we're not talking about doing. We're talking about a one-year TAC. So these are just some things to put this in context, because I think a lot of times we're used to looking at these tacks as if they're right at the FREF level, the FMSY level, because that's how we set them in the last couple of years. But these are not. These tacks are well below either one of them, under either assessment, is well below the overfishing level.
Anyone else in the council? I think we need to figure out what we're going to do with Yellowtail. Can't move on until we do. Dave Gaethel, then Jim Oblin.
I'll make a motion just to get something up on the board for discussion that we set the total allowable catch at 1,500 tons and the U.S. share to be 960 tons.
Is there a second? Seconded by Rip. Discussion. Dr. Pierce.
In the context of this motion, can we return to Tom's point just so I can better understand what he said? He indicated that if the U.S. as well as Canada were at the 2,100, we would have a fishing mortality rate still that is well below the overfishing level. Tom, you may have mentioned it and I missed it, but what fishing mortality rate would we be at if we were at 2,100 metric tons, and how does that relate to the mortality rate we're obliged to set consistent with our control rule?
Well, it depends on whether you're talking the model, the excluding model, which is the pessimistic model, or the including model, which is the optimistic model. A 2,100-ton tack, these are what we reported to the SSC. I don't think they would have changed. Would give you, under the excluding model, they give you an F of essentially 0.1. It's 0.09 something in the third digit, but 0.1. And under the including the model, it's essentially 0.07. So these are both less than half, I think, the overfishing level, which is 0.25 maybe, somewhere up there.
Ben, if you would clarify, we have a control rule that prevents us from adopting those particular fishing mortality rates that would pertain to 2,100 metric tons, correct?
I'm sorry.
What prevents us from going to the 2,100 metric tons, which gives us an F, either 0.1 or 0.07, depending upon whether we exclude or include the high tows?
Well, the issue is that the F rebuild by 2014 at a 75% probability is lower under the excluding model, much lower. And you need a TAC of about 450 tons in order to rebuild by 2014 with a 75% probability. Under the including model, I think the F rebuild is higher up and is actually like 2,600 tons. The F rebuild is 0.085, which is still a pretty low F on this stock.
Jim.
A couple of points. 960-ton U.S. quota is about a 50% reduction from our current year's fishing. I mean, that's basically what we did in 09, or will do in 09 approximately. That's what our TAC was. So it'll be a significant reduction, more than a significant reduction. So, again, for a stock that's well on its way.
Pat?
Yeah. The Canadians, first off, the 1,500 metric tons is the ABC recommendation from the SSC. And the Canadians are looking at the assessment information in one way, and like Jim, I guess, concluding that the stock is well on its way. I read this information pretty critically, and that's not what I see. And I think that needs to be clear to people. This is the information that's in the track report, that the uncertainty is higher than in previous assessments because we don't have the Bigelow calibrations yet and because of the large DFO tows, the two large tows, that the 2007 year class is one of the lowest in the time series, that there's still a truncated age structure, that the resource productivity is lower than historical levels. The F was below the F reference point for the first time in 2008, and that's for the entire time series back to 1973. So far we've only seen 1 year where we've not had overfishing on this resource since 1973. In the past, the realized Fs have all been much higher than was projected. The unexplained change in the survey catchability caused increased uncertainty in the assessment. The high level of uncertainty in the projections, several sources of uncertainty weren't able to be included in the projections that were done. And my one final point is we made a mistake on this stock once before in 2004 when we liberalized before we should have, and I just don't want to see us make that mistake again. So I don't think we have a healthy resource here, and I agree that the Canadians are probably not going to catch the 700 and whatever metric tons, and we should be looking at a lower number, but I think, the 1,500 is the recommendation from our SSC, and so we need to stay within that bound.
Dave Gates.
Yeah. The rationale for these numbers is I support what Pat just said about the 1,500. I think we have to use that number, whether I agree with it or not. But I don't believe, based on the information that's presented in these reports, that the Canadians are going to catch the balance. I mean, if you look at the numbers that are here, the best year they've had landings and discards is 330 tons, and that was in 2000. Recently, it's been less than 100. It's going to take a major reconstitution of their fishery to get up to 540 tons. It's going to be bigger than we've seen in the information we have. So I think this is a relatively safe projection, given the situation that we're in, which is basically impossible, given that we've got two different sets of numbers in two different countries. I don't think we should penalize ourselves unnecessarily for something that probably isn't going to happen.
Jimmy.
Well, yeah. What's the risk of doing this like we do, Heron? Look back the last several years, average their catch, and call that what we assume they'll do this year and move forward. I mean, what's the risk of that?
I had another, I guess, a question either for Jim or Tom. So for the past 2 years, we've had these models, and we've had Canada's had 2 years now with at least one big toe, one huge whopper toe that skews everything. And the decision was to not incorporate that in one of the models. Is that right?
What they actually do is for 2008 and 2009, which are the 2 years where they have a big toe in each one, they don't use this Canadian Survey Index for those 2 years in one of the models. So it's not that they don't just exclude the one good toe. They take the survey index out. I technically don't know how they do it, but they leave the survey index out for those 2 years. And then in the other model, they include it for those 2 years.
So those are the two?
Those are the two differences.
The inclusive and exclusive.
Right.
Now when it comes to determining share allocation, do they also not include?
No, they include that toe.
So the big toes aren't good enough for at least one of the assessments, but they're good enough to determine who gets how much?
Yes.
I don't think that's right, quite frankly. I mean, it may not amount to a significant amount of fish, but just on principle, I reject that. If it's not good enough to determine the biomass and set the quota, it shouldn't be good enough to determine how much somebody gets. Tom?
I mean, we did try and take a look at that to see how much that affected things afterwards. Tom Warren and I looked at it. And it does have a little effect, but it doesn't have as much of an effect as you might think. But, you know, you may still have a point about whether it's an appropriate policy choice or not.
I guess to me it just comes down to, are the fish there or not? Pat?
Yeah, I think, you know, Jimmy's right that it would be, we could reasonably argue that we looked at the past Canadian information. I think we need to take into account this potential test fishery. And deducted that from the 1,500. You know, going back to 2000, the highest amount is around 300. So, and just to be clear, it wasn't less than 100 in the recent past. It was 158 last year, close to 200, I think, the year before that. But anyway, it's in that range. And so that may be a better approach.
Well, I'm going to just to sort of keep the discussion moving, and if the maker of the motion agrees, just a fine tuning to say instead of the 960, to say that the U.S. share will be determined by averaging the last 3 years of the Canadian catch and deducting that from the 1,500.
Yeah, I can accept that. It's fine with me.
And I'll accept it as a friendly perfection. Discussion. Pat?
It doesn't take into account the potential test fishery. It doesn't allow for any expansion of the Canadian fishery. If they set their tack at 2,100 metric tons, then they're likely to allow some expansion. I think we need to go a little bit higher.
Well, I think Pat's suggestion was take the highest of the past 3 years, which is 300. We're splitting hairs, really, but at least we're saying there may be a little more catch this year. So I'm not going to perfect it, but that's Pat's suggestion.
It's fine with me.
So we're not real clear what change you just made.
Yeah, I think.
Okay. The U.S. share. I'm sorry.
1 second. Sorry about that.
As it turns out, the average of the last 3 years is 291. I didn't realize there was 1 year in there where that doesn't show on the table because it all says less than 100. But so the 300, we seem to be saying the same thing. That's my point.
Okay. Discussion? I'll go to the audience. Rich. And then Chris Brown.
Rich Canashton, Bedford. Right now, the Canadian fishery is the yellowtails is primarily all going to discards in the scallop fishery. If there's a test market in Canada, and they're going to be testing it next year, while we're fishing on a tack of 2,500-pound trip limit, 5,000-pound trip limit, the boats are getting 50 to 75 cents a pound. There is no market for yellowtail, and I doubt very much that there will be a market in Canada where they usually fish for a less price than what we do. I would be comfortably at 200 metric ton. And this experimental fish for me, I don't think is going to go anywhere because there's not a market out there today for it. And unless the scallop is in that scallop of fleet discard more fish because the biomass is bigger, that's the only way I could see them going over. Thanks.
Chris Brown, Rhode Island Commercial Fishermen Association. It seems to me that if we are in a year when there is not an agreement between the two countries as to where the tax should be set, if we will ultimately be held accountable for their overages in our eyes, we would be crazy to take them before they occur. We should respond as we are instructed to by law, after the fact. If their fishery occurs at 100 tons, we should be held accountable for that. But we shouldn't give ourselves the hit before it happens. You're setting yourself up to take a much bigger and much harder hit. Next year, when the accounting is finally done, the determination is made that there is a 100 or 200 ton discrepancy that we will ultimately be held accountable for due to the agreement, then we can take it out of stock growth as opposed to taking it up front before it has actually even occurred. We're setting ourselves up for a scenario where they could project the biomass to grow much faster than us, and we may never even get a fishery out of it in the course of a year. I also don't think that this problem is one that you're going to solve in this room exclusively. This has to go back to the politicians, and they have to come out of this, they have to go back and get an agreement with them that there will be some binding arbitration when you come out of that room. It is patently unfair to the American fishermen to have to take the kind of hit that we're taking before the landings actually occur. Thank you.
Okay, back to the council. Jim Auburn.
Yeah, it should be pointed out, I don't have the percentages, but we do this, this is still a significant decrease in the U.S. catch, on the order of 30 or 40%. So we're still going to have an issue. We still got problems. But, I'll support the motion because that's the only way I can see out of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With the discussion with the service, there were some questions on the numbers. It was felt that we'd be better off, and it's a very small adjustment, using the U.S. share will be 300, the U.S. share will be determined by deducting 300 metric tons for the Canadian catch. It's only a 9 different, if that's okay with the maker.
That's fine.
Okay. Discussion, questions from the council? David Pierce.
Yeah, just to follow us through, I'm not sure where the 300 metric tons came from the Canadian catch. But I look at the track status report document, and I look at Canadian landed. Right, okay. Let's see, 10-19. I'm sorry, I see it. Okay. I was looking at the landed versus discard. So you're relating this to the quote. I'm sorry. What's that?
Anything further? You ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. It's 15. Opposed? 1. Motion carries 15-1. Anything else under TMGC, Jim?
Not from the committee's perspective, no.
Anything else from any council member under TMGC? Okay. Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To continue on with the ground fish report, as was indicated earlier, you know, the documents are behind tab 3. The important documents for this afternoon are the document number 3 for the ACL discussion, document number 7 for the ACL subcomponent for yellowtail discussion, and some of the correspondence, document 5A for the Gulf of Maine cod and pollock discussion, 5B for what I'm going to, I termed when I wrote up this up as the interim rule discussion, but it has implications beyond that. The Ground Fish Committee has not met since the last council meeting. I think as we've had some earlier reports, the staff has been focused on working on the Amendment 16 document to get it in final form for submission. We have, at least it was my feeling as Ground Fish Chair, to allow the staff to keep focused on Amendment 16 rather than having them prepping for and attending the committee meetings. There's going to be a report on the an update on Amendment 16, and then Tom's got a presentation and a discussion on the ACL process, and we will discuss the other items that I listed. I'm going to turn it over to Tom at this point to give us a quick update, I think, on Amendment 16 and then go into the ACL, unless you wanted to just go into the ACL, figuring we've had enough discussion on Amendment 16 and where we are.
Well, I'll just be very brief, just so everybody knows. We're still working on completing the Amendment 6 document. We provided the regional office a informal advance copy on Monday so they could start looking at it and start telling us what things need to be corrected. The regional office has also been working on preparing the proposed rule, which they've asked us to review, and we've begun to review that and continue to work on it. That's about where we are. And that's probably the least amount of talking I've done about Amendment 16 in about 3 years. So we'll go on with a report on developing annual catch limits for the groundfish plan, the multi-species plan. There's a couple documents in your binders. I think one is labeled item number 3, which is probably the most important one and is the one you'll probably want to refer to first. There's another document that late in the presentation we'll probably want to turn to. I think that's item number 7. Both of these are PDT reports, with the second one being a joint report from the scallop and groundfish PDTs. My plan today in this presentation, because it's likely to get a little bit lengthy, is that during the presentation I'll stop in a couple spots and give council members an opportunity to ask questions rather than wait till the end and ask questions on a whole lot of stuff. The only other thing I'll mention is that there are some numbers in the memos that you have. Some of them will have to change because of decisions made, like your decision you just made on Georges Bank yellowtail flounder. Others will have to change because we wrote the memo before the TMGC meeting, and so we did not capture what the TMGC recommendations are. So you'll hear me refer to these as preliminary numbers, and I want to emphasize that they are preliminary. My plan today is just to kind of highlight how we thought, and we being the groundfish plan development team, about evaluating management uncertainty and adjusting ABCs to get to the ACLs. I will illustrate the process followed. I'm going to highlight a few specific issues, one with respect to Gulf of Maine cod, just to make sure everybody understands how we calculated the values. And then later during the presentation, Deirdre and I would like to go over some issues with respect to yellowtail flounder and the scallop fishery. I want to make it clear that really what we're looking for today is not really a blessing of the final numbers, because as I just finished telling you, they're not really final numbers. They're preliminary numbers at this point. But we are looking for perhaps either concurrence on our approach or recommendations from the council or guidance from the council, perhaps is a better word, on how you would like us to change our approach in calculating these numbers. And then the idea is that with that council guidance in hand and perhaps with further guidance from the Groundfish Committee between now and November, we will prepare a specifications package for your review and final approval at the November council meeting. The idea here is that after the approval, we'll submit the document to the Fisheries Service, and they will implement the annual catch limits on May 1st of 2010. On the back of the PDT memo, and this is the first PDT memo, item number 3 is a document that the PDT prepared, which is called the Groundfish Plan Development Team Development of Annual Catch Limits for 2010 and 2012. I'm not going to go through the whole document, but what we're trying to do here is to spell out our thinking on how to set ACLs and explain our rationale for how we got to where we did. And our idea here is that this document lays out for the public and the council and anyone who wants to review it what our thinking was and how we got to the final numbers. There was some suggestions during the course of development of Amendment 16 that perhaps this sort of information should be incorporated into the amendment document. And we actually talked about this a little bit with the SSC, and we pointed out that one of the disadvantages of incorporating this type of info in an amendment document is then if you find out 2 years down the road that there are other factors to consider or factors you don't need to consider, well, then you're stuck, really, depending how you write the document, until you revise the amendment. And so our feeling was that it's more appropriate to have this sort of accompany our package so we explain our rationale and document everything, but rather than include it as a piece of the amendment. Now, the first thing we started out with is to try and figure out what are some of the elements that lead to management uncertainty. The national standard guidelines talk about a couple, but we expanded it a little bit. I won't say this list is comprehensive or complete, or no one could think of any other elements that lead to management uncertainty. But these are the ones that we felt were the most important and really kind of capture the issues. Enforceability. You know, can your management measures be enforced? Do you have any guarantee that the things you put in place are actually going to happen? monitoring adequacy. Do you know what the catch is? That's kind of the bottom line. And by catch, I mean landings and discards. Are you certain that you've got some idea of what the removals are from the fishery? Precision of measures, which is perhaps a little bit of an awkward term, but what we mean is if you design a management measure, do you get the result that you're trying to get when you design that measure or implement that measure? How precise are they? You know, some of your measures may be more precise than others. Do you have a lot of latent effort in the fishery that you didn't plan but could plan on but could come in and make your management measures less precise? And then are there other elements of the catch that are beyond your control, either bycatch or discards in other fisheries or perhaps catches within state waters that are not within the control of your management plan, as an example? So these are sort of the things that we think you're trying to account for when you address management uncertainty and an adjustment for management uncertainty. And then kind of with this in hand, we thought for a while about the idea of, as Amendment 16 points out, it may be that it's appropriate to have a different level of uncertainty for different components of the fishery and perhaps even for different stocks. And what we thought is that one way to get at this is rather than to sit there and go through every stock individually and every component of the fishery individually, what we did is we took the approach that we should come up with a default percentage reduction from the ABC and then look at the stocks and components and see if there's a reason to deviate from that default. And deviate doesn't necessarily mean just go down, as you will see. It may mean that you don't need as large a reduction as the default reduction, percentage reduction. Now, I want to point out a problem that we have right away, and that is this Amendment 16 idea that different components should have a different level of management uncertainty. And the reality is we don't have a lot of information on which to base these types of decisions. And probably the biggest one that may draw the most comment today is whether there should be a different level of management uncertainty between sector and non-sector components of the fishery. And the reality is that, in our opinion with the PDT, given the major changes that are proposed on both sides, both the sector side and the non-sector side of the fishery, we're not sure there's any real argument you can make why one or the other would have a different management uncertainty involved. We expect that as we gain experience with this ACL process over time, that we're likely to be able to identify which parts of the fishery warrant different levels of management uncertainty. But we were not convinced that we could do that at this stage. So this seems like, you know, a relatively reasonable approach is pretty straightforward, and of course the $64 question is, what the heck should be the default? Now on the PDT, there was a lot of interest in trying to figure out some way to quantify what should be the default adjustment. And, you know, sort of in a nutshell, we had a very difficult time figuring out if there is a way to quantify this. I put on the board a couple of general approaches that we looked at. We said, you know, well, what are the consequences of exceeding the ABC? You know, if you exceed the ABC, how does that affect you down the road in terms of future catches or stock rebuilding? One of the problems with this approach is the consequences depend on how much you exceed the ABC by. And so you have to start making some assumptions here about what the overage would be. And that leads to what the impacts are. And we were honestly quite uncomfortable with making that assumption of what sort of overages you're talking about. We looked at a second option. This one was in some respects driven by George's Bank Haddock, where we said, well, you know, some of our stocks, there could be considerable risk if the ABC is exceeded, and some there may not be. If you look at George's Bank Haddock, there's two factors there. One, the stock is in really great shape, so you could say that, you know, if you exceed the ABC next year, unless you exceed it by a lot, you're not likely to really damage the stock. And the other point you can make is you can say, look, our catches have fallen well below the ABCs or our target tax for that stock in recent years, so the likelihood, someone might argue, of being able to even get approach our ABC is pretty slim. So someone looks at that. We thought about that, in particular with George's Bank Haddock, and we said, well, you know, this sounds reasonable. What you're really talking about is not really an evaluation of the uncertainty in your ability to manage the catch, but you're really talking about some sort of risk assessment here about what is the risk if you go over. We didn't really feel it was appropriate to take that approach for an evaluation of uncertainty. Then a third approach, this bullet up here, I'm not sure really does it justice, but this was one of the ideas of a PDT member we had that, particularly with respect to sectors, and perhaps with the other part of the fishery as well, but particularly in the case of sectors where you have the fishery managed by what's essentially a hard quota, you know what sort of proportion of the catch may not be observed. Because you have an idea of what the observer rate is going to be, and so, you know, you make some assumptions about how that observer relates to a proportion of the catch. And then you can say, all right, let's suppose on the unobserved portion of the catch that the discards, because you're counting landings because they're all observed, but so you've got an unobserved portion of the catch that's discards, so presumably if we know what proportion is unobserved, then we can apply some discard rates to it and see what happens. And this is sort of an intriguing idea because then you can establish a buffer that's based on what you think may happen if the discard rate is different than the last assessment. And then what happens is you can see how the size of that buffer changes based on how you change the observer coverage. So this is kind of intriguing in a way because this gives you a way to get at exactly what the trade-off is between how much catch somebody gets and the level of observer coverage. The problem is that it hinges on what I mentioned where I talked about this assumed discard rate under sectors. And we don't really know what that is. So, you know, you're basically plugging in some kind of number on what the assumed discard rate is and how it relates to past assessments. Is it going to be higher? Is it going to be lower? You know, how much higher? How much lower? So once again, we felt, all right, this approach is nice, but at this stage, well, it really rests on untested assumptions. We don't really know how the discard rate is going to change. And then with respect to the common pool, you could use a similar approach with a common pool. But again, with the changes in management measures, you don't really know how the discard rate is going to compare to the previous discard rates. So after considering some of these ideas for quantifying the discard rates, we were looking to try and justify a discard rate. And this is spelled out in our memo, but we felt that there should be a couple points. But the adjustment for management uncertainty should be meaningful. This is obviously somewhat of a nebulous term, but, you know, we think that a very small number, certainly management uncertainty is not zero, but we felt that it should be large enough that it is some kind of meaningful adjustment to the catch. When you talk about the common pool, you know, we think our closed area model errors, you know, are somewhere in the range of plus or minus 10%. And the bottom line is what we recommended for the default discard rate is a PDT recommendation of about 5%, of 5%. In other words, the ACL would be set at 95% of the ABC. So with that in mind, we then started looking at things for deviations from that level. And I'm going to run through, I'm not sure this is all of the deviations, but I just want to go through some of these and show you the deviations from the 95%. The first one we talked about was Georges Bank Yellowtail Flounder. This is a stock managed, at least used to be, under the U.S.-Canada resource sharing understanding. We have a hard tack in the area. We essentially have in-season AMs where the regional administrator adjusts trip limits, gear requirements, and access to areas as she monitors the approach on the hard tack. I guess it may not be true in fishing year 2010, but in the past we've had enhanced monitoring in the U.S.-Canada area. But when compared to other areas, I don't know if it's going to be more than other areas, but it's still pretty high monitoring proposed for fishing here 2010. So our conclusion was that, and we've also had great success, really, at being able to keep our catch within this hard tack. And so with this combination of events, we felt that there was less uncertainty for this stock, and we actually recommended a different number. I believe it's 97% rather than 95%. When we looked at southern New England mid-Atlantic yellowtail flounder, we reached a different conclusion. This is one of the few stocks where, since Amendment 13 has been adopted, we have somewhat consistently exceeded the yellowtail flounder target tack for southern New England mid-Atlantic yellowtail flounder. I believe three times, and I think it was 3 years in a row. It also has a pretty large proportion of the catch, in part because the catch is pretty low, but it has a large proportion of the catch, which is, consists of bycatch and other fisheries, which we don't directly control. And so we felt that this led to more uncertainty. We've got a number of stocks in this management plan where we no longer are going to allow retention. Some of these stocks are not allocated to sectors, and while sectors cannot retain them, there's nothing in the sector management plan which makes the sector reduce the catch of these stocks. Bottom line is we felt that a big part of no retention means they're all going to be discards, which increases the uncertainty over these stocks. And then with respect to the recreational harvest of Gulf of Maine cod and haddock, we felt that we have less effective monitoring with the MRF system. We have less predictable measures where we have had difficulty matching up changes in measures with desired changes in catch for the recreational fishery. And we felt these two things led to more uncertainty. So I believe all of these with more uncertainty we set at 90% of the ABC rather than 95%. So this is sort of our general approach, and it lays out our thinking on our adjustments to the ABCs in order to get to the ACLs. And I think this is probably a good spot to stop and offer the opportunity for council questions.
Mary Beth?
Yeah, going back quite a ways there, Tom, you had said that the PDT felt that the management uncertainty was effectively the same for 2010 for sectors in the common pool, which doesn't seem quite right, but maybe you could just offer, you know, some of the rationale behind that. I mean, because I would think that, you know, those sectors are going to have to monitor, you know, their catch quite closely. And granted, there's a lot of questions about how many people might, you know, end up being in sectors, but whatever portion of the fishery does, you would think your management uncertainty would be relatively low.
Well, we can make, I guess our real issue is that we're not sure we have any data to conclude that there's going to be a difference between the two. If you look at our experiences with essentially the common pool, effort controls, we've actually been fairly, and I'll throw out 2004 and 2005, where I think there's evidence that at least some of our target tacks were set too high because we didn't take into account short-term conditions. But if you look at our experience with achieving the target tacks that were set from about 2006 on, we've actually done very well under the effort control measures. We've only exceeded a handful of them that have been set. I believe we've achieved around, our catch has been less than the target tack for over 90% of the target tacks we've sent since Amendment 13. So it's a pretty high result in getting, you know, the catch below the target tack. If you look at sectors, we have a lot of unknowns about this system going into it. You know, on the one hand, they're going to be subject to a hard quota, which the two existing sectors have not had any trouble remaining under their hard quota for Georges Bank cod. But exactly how and all the increased monitoring proposals will work is a little unclear at this stage. And how behavior may or may not change by vessels that are within a sector when they're not subject to an observer on an observed trip is also unclear. And so we don't really know, we felt we don't really know not only who is going to be in the sectors, but we're really not certain how these monitoring programs are going to turn out. And we felt that, you know, given the unknowns in both cases, that we weren't certain that we could justify a different level of management uncertainty for the two components of the commercial fishery. I mean, the council may not agree with that, but that was our rationale.
David Pierce.
Yeah, Tom, just to clarify, the slide you have up on the screen, the deviations, I think you said that for Southern New England Mid-Atlantic Yellowtail, Southern New England Mid-Atlantic, Winter Flounder, Ocean Pout, Windowpane Flounder, Wolfish, Gulf of Maine Cod, and Haddock, we would use a 10% reduction because there's more uncertainty. 10% reduction for them as opposed to the 5% default. What would be less uncertainty? Would there be no deduction if we have less uncertainty? That would be Georges Bank Yellowtail Flounder.
The only one with no uncertainty we did, I'm sorry, the only one with less uncertainty that we concluded had less was Georges Yellowtail, and we did not go to zero. We went, I think, to 97%.
Yes. Okay, so with less uncertainty, 97% specific to that particular stock. But all the other stocks I just mentioned, the plan development team is suggesting 10% deduction, correct?
Right. And just to be clear, for Gulf of Maine Cod and Haddock, that was for the recreational component.
So, I look at the slide, the deviation slide, and it says for Georges Yellow, we have a hard tack, we have in-season measures, or AMs, enhanced monitoring, therefore less uncertainty. So does that mean, does that logic translate into when the common pool is under a hard TAC, and if we continue to have a higher level of monitoring, that we would see the buffer shrink?
Well, I think potentially you could see the buffer shrink for any of these components if we gain some experience. I mean, one of the reasons why with Georges Yellowtail we made this comment about less uncertainty, it's not just because there is a hard tack and in-season measures, but we've seen that those measures have worked now for close to 5 years. And so we felt that it worked for four of the five or three of the four, whatever, however many years we have. So we felt that, you know, supported the less uncertainty. As we go forward with other parts of the fishery, including maybe the common pool beginning in 2012 under a hard tack, or sectors right away under hard tack, presumably if we have the same experience, then we'll be able to reduce the level of management uncertainty there as well. Okay. And, the opposite's true as well. If we find out that these things really don't work, then we're going to wind up increasing the management uncertainty.
Dr. Pierce?
Yeah, Tom, I forgot to ask one thing. When you clarified the deductions, I should have followed up by asking you, if you go from 95 to 97% when you have less uncertainty, that's a 2% difference. Why not go to 93% when you have more uncertainty? Why drop it to 90? Why is it asymmetrical? I realize a lot of this is just subjective, but if there's any logic for dropping it 5% versus 3%, you know, what would it be?
Well, I'm not sure there's a whole lot of logic on dropping 5% down. I will point out that the 10% is sort of the extreme edge of our what we think is the accuracy of the closed area model. However, not all of the fishery, including the wreck fishery, is included in the closed area model, so that, you know, argument only works for some of those stocks that are included in the model.
Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, Tom, maybe you're going to do this, but it would be immensely helpful, at least to me, because my head's swimming from looking at these charts with all these numbers on them. If you took an example of a fishery and started with the ABC and then divvied it all up, in other words, we got ABC, we're taking out so much to get to the ACL, then we're taking out management uncertainty, then we're taking out state waters, the recreational catch, the uncertainty there, the uncertainty in the commercial catch, and then, you know, where we get to the actual numbers so people can see how a great big number turns real small real fast. I think that's what everybody here needs to see and understand. I'm looking at these, like, sector PSCs, and I'm just scratching my head. So if you could possibly do that, if you have a slide that does that, it would, at least for me, be immensely helpful.
I actually have some ideas on that I'll get to once we're done with questions here. So the short answer is we're going to do that, at least for Gulf of Maine Cod, which is sort of an unusual case, and I'll get into why. But we can look at it for others too.
Okay, Tom.
Okay, this is sort of the outline of how we do the calculations. And give me just a second here. Catch up on my notes page. We do this perhaps a little differently than I think some people understand the way we do it, in part because we have so many stocks and so many different components that we have to take into account with many of the stocks. We start out with the acceptable biological catch, and this is, of course, set by the SSC. And then what we do is we distribute the acceptable biological catch to the different components that we've identified. Now, this list in here is not intended to be taken in order, and as you'll hear when we talk about Gulf of Maine cod, in some cases, the way we calculate it is not actually real obvious. So, you know, don't interpret this as being necessarily the order that things get done. However, it is accurate to say that the first thing we do, particularly with the U.S.-Canada stocks, is we figure out what is the U.S. proportion of the catch. And so then all our other numbers fall out from what is the U.S. part of the ABC. So I think if you look at some of the tables, perhaps the summary table, you'll actually see a column that's labeled U.S.-ABC, and that's why it's in there, is because that's after you've taken things out for the foreigners. So the first thing we do is we chop up the ABC into the different components. And then, because in theory at least, we're going to adjust the subcomponents differently for management uncertainty, then we adjust each subcomponent for management uncertainty. And that's how we get to the end result, ACL. So it's actually, on paper, when you write it this way, it looks like it's a pretty easy calculation. It starts to get pretty complicated. So I thought what we'd do, since I was asked and we've got some time, I thought I'd work through 8 or 12 examples here with these spreadsheets.
Okay, thanks, Deirdre.
No, I'm not going to work through any of them on these spreadsheets because I can't even read them. But what I am going to do is I'm going to talk about one of our unusual examples. If you want, I can go through one of the more normal examples, perhaps, by using the pages in the PDT report. If you start with Table 1 in the PDT report, I'm going to start right at the top with Georges Bank cod. This is the first page. If you give me a sec, I might be able to show it for the audience. It's going to be hard to read, but I might be able to zoom in a little bit. You can pay no attention to the notes. Pay no attention to the man behind the screen. So I'm going to start right with Georges Bank cod. This, in some respects, is one of our easy ones. Because there are not a lot of subcomponents for Georges Bank cod. That's why it's one of the easier ones to work through. We start out with the ABC for fishing year 2010, which was set by the SSC. That's 4,812 metric tons. And then this number will change because of the TMGC recommendation that you adopted today. But anyways, we've got another spreadsheet that figures out what the Canadian share is, and it plugs it into this hole. And once again, this number changes. The Canadian share is less than that. And then so it's very simple. You subtract the Canadian share from the U.S., from the ABC, and you now have what I've called the U.S. ABC here, 3,087. So We did an exercise for the Groundfish Committee quite a while ago where this was based on a report that the service actually prepared, where we started looking at how much of these stocks was caught in state waters. And when we did this exercise a while back, for many of these stocks, there's pretty minuscule pieces caught in state waters by the commercial fishery. There are some larger pieces. And when we did this in the past, what we said was, okay, if we don't have a big enough chunk that we're going to give it to state waters as identified, we're just going to put it in this column called other subcomponents. And we slated 5% for those other subcomponents. Well, then, as you'll recall, the council made a decision during Amendment 16 that they wanted something specifically identified, in the council's words, taken off the top for state waters. And so that's why in this column you'll see a lot of 1%s, and you'll see a few numbers that deviate from that. And that's why the other subcomponents, we basically took the 1% out of the other subcomponents, and that's why they're down to 4% in many of these. So, you know, that lops off 5% for these parts, and that leaves 95% for the groundfish fishery. And if you'll scroll along, you'll see that we've got a sector number in here. So you get 95% for commercial groundfish, and based on the September 1st rosters that were submitted for sectors, which of course can change because people can withdraw from sectors, roughly 95% of the commercial groundfish available amount is assigned to the sectors. And that becomes the sector PSC. And the nice thing is that all our shares add to one, which is good news. So far, we haven't created any fish. So then we multiply all those numbers out as you scroll across. And I'll hide this one here again. You merely multiply all those numbers out as you go across, and you get what the components are. And you'll see that you have, in this column, the sector amount, then you've got the non-sector groundfish amount. These are all ABCs. Okay, so then we go to another page, and we look at George's bank card again, and in some cases I repeated info just so I could double check and make sure everything was working right, but this is kind of the same thing. So you start out with ABCs, and now you see these ones and percentage numbers as you scroll through this thing. And what these are is these are the deductions. Now, this is kind of an interesting concept here. You're looking at the other subcomponent, and there's no adjustment for management uncertainty. And part of the reason for that, and here's our logic, is that you don't have any AMs that are going to go in effect when you approach the other subcomponent. So if you think there's management uncertainty about what the other subcomponent should be, the place to adjust for it is not here on this page. The place to adjust for it is to make that number bigger over on the ABC page. You know, take more off the top for that other subcomponent. It's not an ACL. It doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, if you reduce it, well, you haven't done anything. You know, you've actually... You want to make this number bigger if you think there's uncertainty about it. And in this particular example, we have 95% for groundfish because that's what we talked about, and I think everything else is 95%. I've got a number here for rec, but there is no recreational allocation in this instance, so there's no adjustment. This has no effect. I'm just filling in all my squares. MWT is the midwater trawl set-aside, which only shows up for George's haddock and Gulf of Maine haddock. But anyways, if you multiply these numbers out, then you get a number over here. And you'll see that the groundfish number should be lower than the groundfish ABC. And it goes all through. So that's it in a nutshell. That's how you do the simple calculations. I'm going to talk about Gulf of Maine cod because that one's a little more complicated. I want to make sure the council understands how we did it and make sure they agree with the way we did the Gulf of Maine cod calculation, because you may or may not. But, I mean, you know, then the next step is you just take all those numbers and summarize them on one page. You need to be careful with the table because, you know, we assumed the sector rosters were the same for all the years. You know, obviously the chances are good that they're not going to be. The sector rosters could change before the fishing year 2010. Obviously, with the U.S.-Canada agreement, all of the numbers for Georges Bank cod, haddock, and yellowtail, particularly in future years, could be modified depending on what happens on the U.S.-Canada resource sharing understanding. We looked this over pretty carefully, but it's a big table with a lot of numbers, and there's a possibility that we made a mistake that we may not catch till later. So, you know, all of these numbers should be taken with a little bit of a grain of salt. And then once again, the council may decide today that you think our estimates of management uncertainty should be revised, or may ask us to look at other things to consider whether they should be revised. But that's pretty much it. That's the easy case. So if there's any questions on the easy cases, I'd be glad to take them now. There's very few subcomponents. The subcomponents are all relatively straightforward. And so this one is pretty simple.
Dave Gaith.
Okay, so then you take that 27, I need my glasses for these, 2786, and you divide it between the sectors and the non-sectors as well?
Yes.
And so if a person wants to figure out, they've gotten a number from the government that says their potential sector contribution is 0.0-something, let's say 0.05%. For Georges Bank cod, they'd multiply that number, which is 2645 times 0.05?
No. They multiply the commercial groundfish number here by whatever their percentage is.
2786.
They multiply it, yes, 2786 times what their share is.
So that's how people can start to calculate what their sector share potentially could be. It's still not finalized,
but
to give them some rough idea of...
To be real clear on George's cod here, because this is probably one of interest to a lot of people, this number will be higher once we plug in the U.S.-Canada, the correct U.S.-Canada number. It goes up by on the order of 700 tons.
Right.
So, but anyway, and actually the George's yellowtail number will also go up a little bit based on your decision of a couple minutes ago. But, yes, you multiply by this number.
And for the non-sector people, the open category, whatever you call it.
Well, they're not going to know until they know all of the... I mean, they're not going to know until they know how many people are in sectors.
Right. But what we're saying approximately is that 700-odd permits potentially get to catch 141.
Well, it's not exactly accurate. Because of those 740 permits, there's approximately... 400 or almost 500 of them that have no days at sea. So,
okay.
I mean, you're right. Those 700 permits get 141 tons. The reality is there's somewhere on the order of 250 permits with roughly 3,000 days at sea that get 141 tons.
This is the information I'm trying to get out. I'm trying to understand how we're going to deal with the open category and how we're going to deal with basically these small numbers and how, you know, and a potentially large amount of days at sea to catch it. And we'll deal with that later, but just right. To kind of frame the discussion a little bit. And that's the simple one. So now you're going to do what, Georges Bank cod next?
No, that was Georges cod.
The
easiest one to do, which I perhaps should have done first, would have been Georges Bank winter flounder, where there's essentially not any Canadian catch. There's no state waters catch because the stock area doesn't extend to state waters, and no recreational catch, so the only subcomponent is sector and non-sector. That perhaps is the simplest example, but I wasn't thinking. So
we still have a few questions on the floor. Rip?
Thank you. Tom, when I have been asked questions on this, I have referred back to the Amendment 16 draft that is on the website, and I can't remember whether that under the ACL subcomponent section has been updated since it was put up there. But there it says that the overall ACL is determined, and then the subcomponents are divided out of it. So according to that, You do take in the management uncertainty in the subcomponents, but it's the same as you've determined for the larger component.
Well, the reality is that the order of calculation doesn't matter much. But the problem is that when I say the order of calculation, whether you divide it up into ACLs first or divide it into ABCs first doesn't matter much. The language in Amendment 16 also says that for each subcomponent, you may have a different adjustment for management uncertainty. And so from our point of view, the easier way to do this calculation is to divide it up into ABCs and then for each subcomponent apply the management uncertainty amount. If you go the other way, then, you know, essentially what you would do is you would calculate the 95% of the ABC and say that's the available ACL, divide that up into the subcomponents, and then go through the other subcomponents and have to figure out how to do the percentage calculation for each subcomponent. I mean, you can do it. You get to the same number, but we feel it's easier to do the calculation this way because of the decision by the council that they at least want to consider different management uncertainty for each subcomponent.
Pat? Jim Otto.
Tom, can you, there was a premise just put out there that there was 3,000 or something days that we're only going to have. I mean, you could, what I'm trying to get at, that the PSE 97% or what is it, 93% on Georgia's Bank is in sectors. So if there's 3,000 days on boats that didn't sign up for sectors, but their past catch is 3% of the catch, to assume that they can all of us that they're just going to all of a sudden start targeting Georgia's Bank or any other stock and cause a problem, to me is flawed, because there had to be some reason they didn't have any catch in the past 10 years on Georgia's Bank card. Maybe they're too small. Maybe they're not capable of going there, or they don't want to go there, or whatever. So I just. I'm trying to figure out how we quantify that a little better than just saying, well, we've got these 3,000 days and they're only going to be allocated 141 tons of cod, or that we're assuming they're only going to catch 141 tons of cod is not correct. So that's why the question I asked yesterday, I think it was yesterday, was the day before, on what percentage of the days are in the sectors, I think is quite important. And I'd like to hear that answer to that question.
That's what I was actually going to say, and I thought the issue was going to come up later, but we did do the calculation, and 82% of the days are in the sectors. So 12% of the days are, I'm sorry, 18% of the days are common pool days. And the actual number for the percentage of the catch that's in the sectors is somewhere around 95%.
I think we're ready to watch Tom walk us through Gulf of Mancod.
Now, this is our mess. I don't know if it's the messiest, but this is our tough one. This is Gulf of Mancod, and I'm showing you this in a slightly different way than you saw the other screen, because I think it's a little bit easier to follow. And here's the issue: the council's decided to make an allocation between the recreational and the commercial fishery. That allocation is based on a particular time period. And when we made this allocation and the time period, what we wanted to use was the numbers that came out of the GARM in terms of numbers of fish. And quite honestly, we wanted to do this so that there would be no arguing over what the data was. And so using the number of fish that come out of the GARM, recreational, commercial, over the time period, these are the percentages you get. 33.7% for recreational and 66.3% for commercial. Now, the issue here, the key issue here is that causes the PDT problems, is that the GARM percentages are calculated without respect to where the fish are caught, whether they're caught in state waters or commercial. You know, if they show up in MRFs or they show up in the dealer database, they wind up in here. And to be frank, it's very difficult to figure out how much by weight came out of a particular state waters or federal waters program, and it's even more difficult to figure out by number. Now, those of you familiar with MRFs are probably itching to get to the microphone to point out that MRFs does tell you how much, what the numbers of fish are that are caught within 3 miles or within state waters or in federal waters. But if you take a closer look at those estimates, in particular for Gulf of Maine cod, they tend to fluctuate wildly from year to year. And the PSEs for those estimates, you know, the proportional standard errors for those estimates, in some years are approaching 95%. So these are pretty uncertain estimates on the state waters catch. With respect to the commercial fishery, we have, in addition, with respect to MRFs, is we don't know what proportion of those recreational catches are taken on. We know what proportion are taken by party charter boats in state waters, but we don't know is how many of those party charter boats, how much of that party charter catch in state waters is coming from party charter boats that have a federal permit and then thus should be subject to the ACL and AM requirement. So if you take these shares and you divide them up, rec and commercial, and apply that to the ABC, then you get the ABC based on the totals, and once again, this is based on all the fish, and you get a 28.75 and 56.55 metric tons for the ABCs. So now if you go back to the work the PDT did before, we used a NIMS report to Congress that was required by the Magnuson Act to estimate that in the case of Gulf of Maine cod, about 10% of the commercial catch is taken in state waters outside of the federal management plan. This is a number that came out of the NIMS report. And so if you take 10%, and that's the number that we put in there for state waters catch in the amendment. So if you take 10%, and you'll notice I label it all commercial because this is what we've done, and you get 566 metric tons when you round it off. Now, the other thing we did back then is we had this other subcomponent, and once again, back when we looked at this, the way we calculated this other subcomponent was based on 5%, I think, of the other commercial, of the total commercial. So if you take that and subtract those two pieces off, you get an adjusted ABC of 4,807 metric tons for the commercial. Now, hopefully these numbers are right. They should be. If you take 95% as the management adjustment for the commercial, you get down to 45.67. If you take 90% for the recreational, you get to 25.87. If you back it up to make sure the numbers match at the total ABC, they do. They add up. Now, this potentially could cause, I think, you know, just to be right up front with council members, why we wanted to highlight this calculation to you is because this does a couple things, okay? This is slightly different, I think, than what some council members had in mind for how we would treat the state waters catch, and we wanted to be right up front with it. The other thing is that if you look at the recreational ACL, you know, this is basically calculated based on all recreational catch. And so presumably when you're talking about whether to trigger the AM or not, then all recreational catch should be applied to the ACL. It doesn't really mean that the AM has any impact in state waters because it doesn't. And so one could actually argue that, you know, this is not important, but I wanted to highlight this because I think this is different than perhaps what some of the state directors expected. But this is how we got to the numbers that are in the table for Gulf of Maine cod. Okay, I'll move on.
Doug.
So, I'm not going to hold you up. Just to clarify, so is that applies to everything in the column under state waters. When you're talking about state waters for all species, you're talking commercial only.
No. No, as I mentioned, Gulf of Maine cod is kind of a screwy one here. Gulf of Maine cod is the screwy one.
You might have to go through another example then of something that has a recreational allocation to show me how, since that's the only one that this applies to. That state waters is commercial only. I mean, is a commercial state waters harvest only? Then we can finish with Gulf of Maine cod, but I'd appreciate having another example then as to how, for example, with Gulf of Maine haddock, what is that? Is that
Gulf of Maine haddock? I'll be perfectly blunt. When you look at MRFs and Gulf of Maine haddock, almost none of it is caught. Very small proportions are caught in state waters. Technically, we have this same problem with Gulf of Maine haddock, but it's such a small number, we didn't really bother with it. I mean, if we could go back and do the same approach for Gulf of Maine haddock if that's what the council prefers, for consistency's sake. It's the only other stock where we have a specific recreational allocation under the federal part of the plan, anyway.
After you go through the rest of your Gulf of Maine cod portion here, I may ask you about winter flounder then.
I wasn't going to go through anything else on Gulf of Maine cod, absent questions from council members. So I was done.
Can I ask you about winter flounder then?
If you give me a minute or two to refresh my memory on how we did winter flounder, yes. But winter flounder is different for a couple reasons, I think. One of the big differences with Gulf of Maine winter flounder is that if you go back to this NIMS report on how much is caught by commercial fishermen in state waters outside the federal management plan, meaning by a boat that doesn't have a federal permit, the numbers are very small. On the other hand, the recreational catch in state waters for both Gulf of Maine and southern New England winter flounder are something on the order of 97-98%. Essentially, all of the recreational catch comes out of state waters. And so I think we addressed this perhaps in our PDT report. So give me a second here. If you turn to our PDT report on page 5, with respect to the two winter flounder stocks for the recreational fishery, we went to recent data and tried to figure out what recent recreational catches have been and tried to use that as a basis for determining what they might be going forward after taking into account or attempting to take into account the fact that ASMFC has revised some of the recreational management measures in an attempt to reduce the recreational catch in state waters. So in the case of both Gulf of Maine winter and southern New England mid-Atlantic winter flounder, we looked at the catches. We, in recent years, basically 06, 07, and 08, I believe, and we allowed an amount taking into account the reduction that ASMFC is trying to put in place. And then what we did is we said, okay, you know, how much of the ABC is that amount? And we plug in the percentage that gives us that amount in that table. So in the case of Gulf of Maine winter flounder, we're basically saying we expect 25% of the ABC to be caught by recreational fishermen in state waters in the Gulf of Maine, because we allowed for about 60 metric tons. 60 metric tons is higher than what it averaged from 05 to 07, but then in 2008, the recreational catch appears to have increased by a lot. So the 60 metric tons is kind of between the two numbers, between the average and what went up in 2008. And we're assuming that the measures are going to reduce the catch. If you look at ASMFC's, at least the documents available on their webpage, they're trying to reduce harvest 11%. So basically we said, we'll take 89% of the 2007 to 2008 average. And that gives us 25% of the ABC, or about 60 metric tons. And that should be the number that shows up for the state waters catch on the ACL summary table, because there's essentially no commercial state waters catch to speak of. It's a very small percentage. So if you look at Gulf of Maine winter flounder, for example, on Table 3, state waters is 60 metric tons. That's basically all wrecked. Similar process was followed for southern New England mid-Atlantic winter flounder. If you were to go down to Atlantic halibut, you would see that we think roughly half the Atlantic halibut is taken in state waters, and so that number down there reflects commercial, not necessarily recreational, but that number there down there reflects a state waters catch. And while I'm on this subject here, because if you think about it, this is a little backwards. We're figuring out the number we want and then writing in the percentage that gives us that number so our table works, as opposed to saying, okay, we're going to allocate, we don't allocate to the states, a percentage and put it in there. One of the things we discovered as we went through this is that when we did a lot of our earlier calculations, you had things that were, you know, small numbers of the catch. Just as an example, in the past, the pollock recreational harvest used to be on the order of 300 metric tons. The fishery is catching 11,000 tons over the last few years. 300 metric tons is a pretty small percentage. Well, it is a small percentage until you cut the pollock ABC down to about 3,800 metric tons, and suddenly that 300 tons starts to become, 5 or 10%, 7%. Of the pollock catch, so you no longer can just look at it. So in some cases, as we explain in our PDT memo, we had to take that into account, the fact that, the numbers used to be a small part of the catch, but they may not be a small part of the proposed ABC. Pollock is actually a good example of that for a couple reasons. One is there's Canadian catch. The other is that in 2008, the recreational harvest of pollock seems to have increased from 300 tons to, I think, over 900 tons, according to MRFs. And so we have to plug in a number that seems to represent pollock. If you believe MRFs, a good percentage of that pollock is harvested within state waters. And so our state, we basically came up with an approximation, what we thought might be taken by the recreational fishery for pollock. And we put, because we don't have a specific allocation for pollock now, we put half of it in the state waters chunk, and we put half of it in the other subcomponents.
Doug, you okay for now? Go ahead.
Just one comment to you, and the thing that stuck out to me about Gulf of Maine winter flounder and the state waters component, which you're saying is essentially recreational, at least the data that our technical committee provided for us in our addendum for that, our most recent addendum, was saying that the recreational component, if you amounted to 10% of the entire harvest. And I don't know if you folks were using different years than they were, but that seems to be a huge difference. And I'm probably go talk to the technical committee as to what they used, and I assume you've got the years that you used in that component.
I think there's actually two things here. As I suspect that they did not use the 2008 data, which is a number that increased by a lot, according to MRFs. So if you go back and look at the data we used, it probably was on the order of 10%, because I think the Gulf of Maine winter flounder catches have been in the vicinity of 300 tons recently, and the recreational harvest has been, you know, 25, 35, I think, in that area. But we're setting our ABC at 75% of 300, so that immediately bumps the percentage up above 10%. And then if you factor in the 2008 harvest by the recreational fishery, it also bumps that number up. So, you know, we've got a number of 60 tons, which is basically, you know, didn't get calculated that way, but it's basically partway between what they were catching 05, 06, 07, and partly between what they caught in 08.
Okay. You all set, Doug?
Yeah.
Okay. I think we need a wake-up break, but nothing personal, Tom. But before I call for the break, Mayor Lang from New Bedford is here, and he's asked if he could make a couple of remarks. So if he's in the room right now, I'd ask him to come forward.
Am I on? That was a heck of an introduction. I appreciate that. And I'm going to be very, very brief. I don't want to get in the way of the break at all. I appreciate you calling me before the break, though, because I only have a few points to make. And I'm here as a friend of the New England Fisheries Management Council. And I have some observations to make and hopefully some questions that you'll keep in mind. And this comes from the Port of New Bedford, which I believe is the number one fishing port in America. It's one of the oldest, and it certainly has the highest cash value. It accounts for $1 billion worth of economic stimulus throughout the greater New Bedford area. I also want to bring my regards from Mayor Carolyn Kirk from Gloucester, and we know the history and the tremendous value of their port as well. And we were talking today at the Mass Mayor's Association meeting, and I indicated I was going to come by and speak for New Bedford, Gloucester, and I believe ports that have similar points of view regarding the work that you're doing now. First thing, and I understand that this was discussed earlier today, is that if we are going to be involved in a rebuilding project that involves the fisheries that we share with Canada, it seems to all of us that we need some sort of a bilateral agreement, that Congress needs to act immediately, otherwise we are going to be preserving a fishery that is eroded on the other side of the line. And I think that's something that we all believe very strongly in. If we are going to come up with a program, it has to be adhered to by Canada as well. There has to be, I'm sure people are working on this, but this has to be a priority. Otherwise, we'll watch our catch or our catch share being taken by the Canadian vessels. The other thing that I want to point out is that the sector program, which we've watched develop in New Bedford, the catch shares part of the sector program, what I hear constantly throughout the port is that no one is sure how this is going to be implemented. No one is sure what the impact is going to be on their individual vessels. Multi-permit holders feel strongly that they'll get through 2010. Single-permit vessels do not know whether they will get through 2010. If the strategy is to winnow out the port, then it seems to me we will suffer extreme social and economic consequences. All of that should be studied ahead of time. We should understand exactly what the impact is on the number one port in America. It seems to me if we are going to be in a situation where we lose a great number of vessels in our port, we are going to lose infrastructure in our port. We're going to have an effect on everyone from icing to repairs, fuel, processing, this is not going to be something that simply we can look at and say, we hope that the catch shares accomplishes some sort of management of the fisheries. I think that I've been here now many times. I know that this is a very, very difficult area. This relies on a science that's developing rapidly. But I have yet to hear anyone dispositively indicate what these programs will do to protect the fisheries. I can tell you, though, dispositively that they're going to have a tremendously negative effect on the people who are involved in the fishing industry and who depend on the fishing industry. And I think that one of the, you know, one of the foundations of the Act is that we assess and factor in the socioeconomic impact on the actions that are taken. And it seems to me that New Bedford, Gloucester, all the different ports that are in our region need to be consulted as exactly what we think the various scenarios will produce. And I think we have, again, we have the expertise. I think New Bedford has great scientific expertise, but we have the practical expertise to run through these models and explain to you exactly what we're going to lose in the way of employment, in the way of day-to-day quality of life. And I think it's extremely important to factor that in as you go through your work. So thank you very much for allowing me to speak.
Okay. Thank you, Mayor. Thank you. Any questions for the Mayor? Okay. Thank you. We'll go on break for 15 minutes.